So thank you. Thanks for that, Art. That felt great. I do yoga, but yoga pretty much always hurts. And in fact, that's kind of how I know my body is doing it right. It's like the more thoroughly it hurts, the more I'm doing it. That's what the teacher's saying. But Qigong felt different. It's very, very nice. Yeah. So welcome. Nice to be with you. I see some Spirit Rock infiltrators over there. Nice to see you. Yeah. So we're missing the Academy Awards. I don't know if that was in. Point of renunciation, and the dharmas, but I say that because the films are all about stories, and we love the arc of a story of something beginning, middle, end, or something that has a kind of a coherent narrative. And I know, like in Dharma talks, sometimes the rhythm of talks are like some kind of point, didactic point, sutta reference, illustrative story, right? And the stories, people like stories, yeah? We all like stories to some extent. And curiously, in spiritual circles, like, stories tend to get a pretty bad rap, I don't know this, I don't know Byron Katie's stuff, but I know she wrote a book that's something like, who would you be without your story, And that's like the key prompt. And that's a deep question. That's a beautiful question. And yet, in an important sense, the Dharma is a story, right? Not just literally the story of the Buddha, the kind of regal prince, protected from the kind of realities of suffering, and then only to like wake up to them. Not merely that story, but actually the whole of the Dharma, in a sense, is a story that we tell about the human condition, about the possibilities for freedom, about a path to freedom. And so it is in fact a kind of a story of suffering, of freedom from suffering. So that's on one hand, but then the other hand is that the Dharma is said to be it's immediate, it's here and now, visible to the wise. Don't look elsewhere, right here. Don't look into the realm of story. Don't put this moment into some grand narrative about freedom. Just look right here. And so we have these two sides, stories and not stories. Stories and the immediacy, the intimacy of the moment. And I want to talk about how this fits together, how we think about this in our Dharma practice. And what I would say is, mature Dharma practice, to my mind, weaves in and out of story. There's a kind of facility with living in narrative, in a story, and also a kind of reverence for the immediacy and the simplicity of the moment. So, story. We come to practice in a way really beleaguered by stories that don't work. Yeah, even a laugh there, yeah.
A lot of stories,
and they are both, you know, often a kind of expression of pain, of dissatisfaction, and they often compound dissatisfaction, yeah? And so we recognize that, you know, in a way that we've been living in stories, like very deeply embedded in stories born of greed, hatred, and delusion. Yeah. There's the three kind of prime movers in terms of suffering in the Buddhist psychology. So the stories that we tell about our lives, about the world, are you know, when we're unpracticed, they're often stories that emerge out of greed, out of aversion, out of delusion. Stories about stories that like they bubble out of the clinging. They maybe often justify the clinging. And so there's stories about what we'll get or what it'll be like when we don't have that thing, that problem. And then there's stories of just the deluded stories of the ways we just fail to really appreciate how clinging is functioning. You know? It's like the delusion is a justification, a rationalization of the greed and the aversion. And we live very deeply embedded in those stories. Now, the Dharma gives us another kind of story, right? It's a story that is empowering, that's meant to liberate. And it begins with our own dignity. And I don't know where it comes from, or if there's some other precedent other than the speaker who said it, but Jack Kornfield, I remember, said something like, you are a child of the Buddha, you know, to the group of us sitting. And there was something just, you know, just very kind of sweet and meaningful about that idea. It's like, oh, you know, that's a different view, you know, like, than this, like, deeply neurotic, confused being. Like, oh, child of the Buddha. Okay, I will try that on, see how that feels, yeah. And the storyline goes on. The story is like, not only a child of the Buddha, but like this life is precious. Your life is precious. Sentience, being alive, is precious. And early in practice was in the practicing in Tibetan lineage, and there's an image of you know, to be this, there's real emphasis on, like, it's a big deal to be born as a human, you know. It's a big deal to be born in the first place, but it's a really big deal to be born as a human. And the image was that, you know, that like illustrating the chances of being born human, they said, imagine in the entire great sea, there was one small ring floating on the surface of the water, and every 100 years a turtle would pop its head up somewhere in that enormous vast sea. The chance of being born human is as if the turtle poked their head through that ring in the vastness of the sea. And so there's this sense of like no time left to lose, really, and a kind of deep honoring for what seems so natural, like, oh yeah, I was born, I'm alive, right? And here we are, human. And it seems like, well, there are 7 billion of us now, and, you know, many billions to come, billions before, right? Like, that's not such a big deal, right? But it's a big deal. The story continues to say that transformation is possible. That actually pain can be redeemed. You know, that's sort of like, yeah, one of the most soothing things about, you know, about this path is like this confidence, this lived confidence, like pain can be redeemed, that it's actually possible to transmute a pain into understanding and love. And so the heart can begin to relax the anxiety around what life will bring, because there's a certain kind of trust in the heart and a trust in, maybe we say, in the Dharma, that actually pain can be redeemed. And so practice gives us new stories, and it also the Dharma practice, meditation practice, it helps us smooth out our autobiography, you know? The story that we tell about who we are, where we came from, how these experiences impacted us, you know, it actually helps us tell a more coherent story, the story of our life, right? Because a lot of times we get to practice and it's a kind of jagged story with chapters that maybe don't fully fit together, and there are sort of like periods of time where we're real thin on the details, and then other experiences where we're still like totally enmeshed in it, yeah. And so there's a way in which you know, the kind of pain of any human life, or the trauma of a particular life, fragments the kind of coherence of our autobiography. And there's a sense of, our story doesn't totally hang together. And we couldn't tell it in a kind of clear, open-hearted, smooth way. Does that make sense? Yeah. And practice, it's like we begin to actually transform the sense of our history, because we're really looking back on our past and blessing it with a Dharma heart. And naturally, the past comes up, the past arises, and we begin to like integrate it into a more coherent sense of who we are and where we've been and who the people in our life have been and their capacities and their suffering. We begin to actually take some of the thorns out of our history, and in doing that, it actually enables us to tell our story in a new way. You know, and for some people, like, just to be able to actually tell one's story is an accomplishment. You know, just to actually be able to narrate one's life and one's past is an accomplishment. And practice really helps with this. And so we start to tell a kind of a story that's based on Dharma, based on the understandings that we develop on the cushion, based on the teachings. And it's a story that that acknowledges the realities of suffering, the complexities of being human, the ways that our own suffering and the suffering of others overflows and spills out, impacts others. We begin to tell the story about change, the impermanence, the transiency of life, the ungraspability of life. This is a much more mature story than the story we tell when we arrive at the first gate of Dharma. And the last thing I'll say on this front is that if we get the idea that story is the kind of nemesis, you know, what starts to happen is we have this like getting these skirmishes with our own mind and with our own thinking and the way thinking is arising, the way we're telling stories to ourselves as we sit, as we live. And if we have this kind of rigid sense of the Dharma is exclusively like non-story, then we can get into these kinds of little internal battles with our own thinking and the mind's, I think, quite healthy tendency to try to heal our past through more and more mature stories, more and more mature autobiography. So that's one side. That's my plug for stories. Yeah. And the Dharma is always here and now, right? That's the other side. Never elsewhere. It's about intimacy and immediacy. And so we start to appreciate the way that that stories are always abstractions. They're always at least an attempt to like impose a certain order on the unspeakable richness of sensory experience, to name and confine things within names. This is what our narratives do. And our allegiance to story making, to narrative, it runs so deep. It's very hard for us to get this, I feel, but we really do try to think our way to liberation. Without totally knowing that we're doing it, like we're like kind of just rearranging the mental furniture a little bit, you know, and just like, just gonna, yeah. And then we get identified with these Dharma stories and we can, fail to appreciate them as abstractions. And so we actually seek our redemption within more and more satisfying Dharma stories. Yeah? And every story has the nature of, is unsatisfying in some way. There are better and worse stories for sure, but no story will actually bring the sense of completion to the heart that that the moment can. So, when we actually get quiet, what we can start to see is that that the kind of the compulsion to tell stories It's an expression. I feel we can test this out ourselves, but in my experience, it's an expression of a certain kind of primitive fear and an urgency for security and safety. Like it's so innocent. It's so innocent that the mind works in that way, that we like really rely so deeply on story and narrative to stay oriented to everything, to know where the threats are and where the opportunities are. And the more we narrate the moment, the more we narrate our meditation, narrate our lives, the more we can keep our eyes on the ball, you know, meaning how to stay safe. Yeah. I was sitting a couple weeks of retreat recently, and I was like doing some walking practice kind of in the night, and you know, there was this sense of the mind was quiet, and there was this sense of a certain kind of terror in not talking to myself about experience. You know? Like there's a like when you just and it felt a little different, you know. It's like, yeah, just a little different sense of the kind of engine of thinking. It was like to like really let go, which is required for a lot of this path, to let go into samadhi, into the gathering of the mind, into a deeper seeing, insight. These things really have to actually let go of the compulsion to keep narrating one's life, you know, narrating one's dharma life, you know, narrating one's sit, one's walk, one's retreat, one's class, right? And actually just like in a way confront some of that maybe subtle fear, sometimes intense kind of almost terror, like in not talking to ourselves about ourselves. And there's a way that the further we actually get from like our homeostasis, the further we get from our baseline, you know, the kind of baseline of things feel okay, you know, the further we get from that baseline, positive or negative, the more urgent it becomes to narrate our life. And it's like the storytelling is a way of modulating our inner life moment by moment. And part of the practice is learning actually to surf high intensity states wordlessly. Like we really trust thinking so much, like to tell the story of what's happening, what the problem is, what the solution is, that we're okay, that we're gonna get more, that we're gonna get rid of, like that kind of like, yeah, the kind of energy behind that is so intense. And we're learning to actually develop some trust that we can ride the intensity without modulating our life through story. And that's part of why a kind of radical safety is necessary. That's why when we sit retreats, we take the precepts in a real way. Like it's like, We're not going to harm each other. We're not going to harm each other. And that begins to create some of the sense of actual refuge that makes it more and more safe to venture into our inner life without the life preserver of narrative. To just start to like sink in a less defended, less structured, braced way. So, one of my teachers said, Shinzen Young, this is just his distillation of really a core Buddhist teaching, but he said, like, know yourself as a sensory system. Yeah. Know yourself as a sensory system. And they, you know, you can break up the kind of, we can draw a circle, the whole pie of everything we might experience, the different channels of data coming into awareness, right? Of the five senses and the mind, or the aggregates, or different ways we can cut up experience. But the Buddha said, like, know yourself as, like, there's nothing outside that pie. Thinking sort of takes us outside. It like creates a sense of like being divorced from nature, divorced from ourself as a sensory system. But the practice is like, no, just look right here. There's nothing outside of these senses. We begin to like flood the channels of data with awareness. You know, you just like dump all of the awareness into the sensations of the breathing or the body or hearing or internal conversation or mental images, right? Emotional sensations. It's like the mind wants to like retreat into narrative, and it's almost like sometimes you have a sense of like pushing, you know, pushing it back out. You know, I really feel this doing walking practice. It's like you can almost feel the collapse into the narrative, you know, as we like it dawns on us the aimlessness of pacing back and forth, you know. It's like sitting. We're getting something done. But when you're just walking back and forth, it's like, and then you can it's almost this energetic phenomena of like the attention just collapses, pools up, and you just lose contact with the visual field, with the somatic field. So we keep reestablishing the intimacy with sensory experience, knowing ourselves as a sensory system. And even when life feels like it's somewhere else, namely in our story, you know, like, no, this is it. This is it. This is my life. This is your life right now. Yeah. And so in an important sense, meditation is just paying attention to what we call our life, which is the flow of experience. So, as we become intimate with experience, it start to appreciate, like, okay, this really is my life. That meditation practice, in a way, is honoring my life. Just to pay attention to the breathing. This is we're getting as close to our life as we can. And often the mind wants to learn before It's like insight, in a sense. We're in the insight meditation tradition. Like insight is a kind of primitive form of story, right? Ways of it's like we, these are the goodies we take back from the other side, you know, from the quiet, from the dark, from the unknown, bottomless present. But often we like rush in to generate, to manufacture insights rather than letting them bubble out of the intimacy. Yeah. So you know that experience of sometimes I'll be practicing and I'll take one breath, you know, like, all right, that was a good mindful breath. And then I'll like check in to see, what have I learned? You know, like, am I more concentrated? Did I learn? Is there any insight or letting go from that breath? And maybe I'll give it a few more. Like, and then I'll check again. I'll double check to see, right? But it's like, no. We get this sustained, simple contact. And we sort of like nuzzle up, you know. There's this you know, somebody's dog, golden retriever, yesterday, who I was playing with, that, you know, the dog was like not content merely to be pet, you know. It was like, I'm gonna like snake my way through any space, you know, between your legs, and just up. Nuzzled in there, you know, and that's kind of like that is the image I have with practice of like we're sort of like nuzzling up in that kind of way, and we start to actually see how alienated we've often been from the immediacy of sensory experience. And just how much we've located our life in very elaborate stories, yeah. And they're the best stories they're the best we can do to understand our life and the threats and opportunities of being human. They're the best we can do. It's like so innocent. But when we locate our life purely in that realm, there's a kind of alienation that happens, and there's something that, even though the breath might be boring, or there may be pain or heartache or different kinds of unpleasantness when we turn inwards, there's something in the heart that relaxes when we really start to connect with our experience, even when it's unpleasant. You know, and it's like this subtle sense of like of coming home, you know. And we can come home to pleasantness or unpleasantness. It's in that intimacy. Now, the more intimate we get, we start to see that even what we maybe thought of as the present moment was a subtle, had a narrative component to it. Yeah. So what we think of as here and now, that changes over the course of practice, right? Like what we call the present, what we think of as a moment, what we think of as the breath, that actually changes over time. And so sometimes just very subtly, there's no such thing as the breath, right? It's just a flow of sensation. But sometimes we can be paying attention in these kind of like conceptual units, the in-breath, the out-breath. And we're overlaying a kind of like subtle narrative on experience. And to be even more intimate with experience, the notion of, you know, the in-breath, the out-breath, your body, your mind, all of that dissolves in the intimacy of the present. And we know more and more of our life as we start to see more and more of what just was like totally unquestioned experience is known, in fact, as story. The story of the self. What felt like the kind of ground of our being, the perspective from which everything was gathered and received, that actually is known as this like more and more subtle layers of story. And sometimes you say like experience has a kind of density, you know, and in our stories it's very dense. Like the stories, like when we're like fully in, identified with some narrative, like it's a very, the experience just feels dense. And the more still we get, the more quiet we get, the kind of lighter and more transparent, thinned out, ephemeral, empty, less and less density to experience, to the experience of mind, of body, of hearing, of even sight. That there's a way in which the clinging makes everything more real. That it's actually it's clinging that actually increases that sense of the density of our life. And as we settle and as we start to drop out of the narrative mode into intimacy, there is it's like there's less and less and less of our life left. And then maybe the bell rings, or we smell lunch, or there's a sound that we hate, and something re-coagulates, you know. But increasingly in our life, it's like that. The intimacy becomes a reference point. It casts a kind of shadow over all of our stories so that they are held a little bit more lightly. It's not that we rid ourselves of them. As we started, is like mature Dharma practice is weaving in and out of narrative. But when we start to know, you know, to know the bottomlessness of the present moment, we just hold all of our stories with a little more lightness. And we bring back, as I was describing, the sense of the like insights, things that we're learning about the human condition, learning about suffering and love and freedom, And they maybe crystallize in the form of insights, things that we, kind of things we say we know, that feel like they're in the bones, that actually transform our behavior, you know? Not mere conceptual abstractions, things that actually like, oh yeah, that's going to change how I am in this world. Yeah. And those insights are a kind of story of sorts, yeah. But there's the energy behind it is like the energy of letting go rather than the energy of clinging. In our own practice, we can be attentive to the stories we tell, how they've changed, how we hold them, how they fit together with that which is not story. So I offer that for your consideration and pick up whatever is useful, whatever part of that 40-minute story is useful, and leave the rest behind. Thanks. So we have a few minutes for any questions or reflections, clarifications, dissenting views. And you don't have to ask a question to rescue me from the silence. It's like we acclimatize to awkward silences as deep meditation teachers.
It's funny because I was having issues with stories. Maybe not issues, but during the meditation tonight, I came in with a racing mind and about 6 dominant stories.
Yeah.
And then I went to drop that away, and another story from 35 years ago just sort of popped up. Yeah. And I was noticing how I was relating to that.
Yeah.
And working with that. But that's not really what I wanted to say. Just that one of the things I notice is that when I feel closest to my own Buddha nature is oftentimes when I'm outdoors or, you know, looking at a bird or standing on the patio with my dog staring up at turkey vultures soaring around, looking at the stars at night. And I just think how, in terms of stories, how much our very that complex and fabricated world that we live in, just to get from 1 hour to the next in the day, you know, and the technology and driving our cars and all that is just, I mean, this is just a thought, really.
Yeah.
It just lends itself so much to creating stories.
Yeah.
I don't know if that means that our world is more difficult to be our true, more like our true human animal nature today than it was 500 years ago or not, but I just do like to acknowledge that it is more difficult because it is so material and we have so much stuff.
Yeah, thank you.
talking about past. I have found that when I was in a retreat,
yeah,
and I really feel as if my mind has quieted down.
Yeah.
Occasionally, I mean, there was one instance. It was the little bench that's above, outside. I was just sitting there, and just it was like one of those moments where you just—it's just so beautiful. And it was evening, and it was like unbidden. This feeling came up. And I also do theme songs, and this song came up, and there was kind of a story there, but it was really more of a felt sense, and the felt sense was a felt sense of me at 8 years old, and I just tried to be with that without creating a story, and actually somewhat successful. But it was one of those moments where you talk about where there was this life experience that I had as an 8 year old that I had made a story about what it was, and I got to experience it again as an adult in a Dharma situation, and I got to see that the story that I had made about it, it just disappeared.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it took a while, but it disappeared, and I think that's a really valuable tool. The Dharma gives us.
Yeah, beautiful, yeah. It's like there's this realization, like, I was eight or I was whatever it was, and of course I didn't understand it with the full force of wisdom and compassion, and so naturally it's gonna constellate in a story that's not born of wisdom, you know, and then you actually experience the feeling with it, and then maybe something is released, that story is transformed, and it's told in light of all the wisdom and practice that you've accrued, and that can be a real deep release emotionally. It's beautiful. Thanks. Thank you.
This is a little quick, but the trouble with the Dharma is that now when I hear those stories, I think, they're ruined.
say it like
stories are ruined. I mean, they're not, because you see what right through them, the needs that you have, and they're just not useful.
It's kind
of a bummer.
Yeah.
But it's funny.
That's part of the value of retreat is we get to see the construction of stories and their dissolution, you know. And so often it's like these stories, they just often like bubble out of not liking or not liking, you know. They just like bubble out of these like primitive valence, you know, kind of pleasant, unpleasant, vedana, whatever, and then it's like this whole elaborate thing that is this story of revenge and triumph or whatever, you know, whatever it is, and it's like about the salad bar, you know, or whatever, you know. It's just like, and then the mood changes or whatever, and it just all collapses, and we see the precipitous collapse of like, holy shit, I was just living in that whole melodrama though for whatever, for an hour or a day or a lifetime or whatever, and it's just like, oh, it's empty, empty, empty.